including France and anybody else that would be shown to have had a role in the genocide, they would actually have to pay reparations. They, or their officials would have to be taken to court and face charges of genocide. And so I think that's a part of the reason why President Macron is avoiding an official apology. Although I do think that the government of Rwanda itself, the president of Rwanda himself, should also respond to the charges against him about sparking the genocide, because the genocide was sparked by the shooting of the plane, and a lot of his own officers have testified to it, including courts in France.
Official documents, survivors' testimonies, historic reports, books, and investigations have made available a barrage of information on France's participation in the Rwanda genocide. Researchers, however, estimate the classified secret documents in the government's archives still hide the truth.
Rwanda has long accused France of complicity in the 1994 genocide, but during Macron's visit to Kigali, President Kagame evidently softened his hardline stance. This is what he had to say after listening to Macron's speech.
His words were something more valuable than an apology. They were the truth.
Well, our last question to you, Professor. Why has President Kagame changed his previous hardline stance on France?
Well, I think both leaders had good reasons to try and establish normal relationships again. As far as Kagame is concerned, he has been, to some extent, I wouldn't say abandoned, but his usual allies, particularly the British and the Americans, have become more and more critical about his politics, about the level of democracy, human rights abuse, etc. It's also, I think, important for France because they have been, in part because of the conflict with the Rwandan regime, they have been basically out of Central Africa, or at least out of the Great Lakes region, which is an important region for them because it's a border between Anglophone and Francophone Africa.
Thank you very much, Professor Rengens. Professor is an author and academic, and he's also an emeritus professor of law and politics at the Institute of Development Policy, University of Antwerp. Now, back to you, Claude. Why is President Kagame eager to mend Rwanda's ties with France at this point in time?
Kagame's approaching of France is also a political move, because what has happened is, traditionally, Kagame has been a, if I can use this word, a puppet of the West. He's been basically a servant of Western governments, the UK and the US being the primary sponsors of Paul Kagame. And in recent years, they've started to distance themselves from Kagame and his government. And because of that, he's looking for new friends. And France itself is losing its influence on the continent of Africa, and Rwanda being one of the former French-speaking countries where France used to have an influence, I think France is trying to recover some territories.
France has deployed thousands of troops in several African countries to ostensibly battle terrorism. But despite this military presence, terrorists and bandits continue to wreak havoc in these countries where French troops are present.
Now, as we wind up, I'm sure you recall that the French military operation during the Rwanda genocide was carried out under the guise of a humanitarian mission. Is history repeating itself in other French military missions in Africa that are being carried out to ostensibly battle terrorism?
You know, you look at so many places where they're involved in the Central African Republic, you know, how close they are with Cameroon and Chad and so many others, and you can tell their reason for being there, and in Libya and Mali and so many other places, their presence is problematic. Even in the Ivory Coast, their history there. It's been a when the French go there, again, history repeating itself, they go there really to occupy, to take over, to take control of those countries, to install their puppet leaders, or to turn the leaders there, the current leaders, into puppets that they control and then take control of resources. And they do not actually care about fighting terrorism or saving lives. They are there to serve the interests of France, which are purely economic interests and not interests of saving human lives or even fighting terrorism.
Well, you have it there. France is pursuing selfish economic interests in its renewed engagement with African countries. Thanks a lot for your analysis, Mr. Claude Gatabuke, a Rwandan war and genocide survivor and the executive director of the African Great Lakes Action Network. Now, let's take a short break, and when we come back, we shall discuss the rejection of Germany's genocide deal with Namibia. So don't go away.
Namibians reject Germany's genocide deal.
From 1904 to 1908, German colonizers waged a brutal campaign of genocide against the Herero and Nama people in present-day Namibia. It was estimated that 65,000 of the 80,000 Herero, that is around 80% of the Herero population, were killed during the genocide. Some 10,000 of an estimated 20,000 Nama were also brutally killed by German colonial forces.
More than a century ago, after these atrocities it committed, Germany has now issued a late apology and promised development aid to those affected. Foreign Minister Heiko Maas says that Germany for the first time recognizes that it had committed genocide in Namibia during its colonial period. Many Namibians have rejected the so-called development aid being offered by Germany as compensation for its colonial-era genocide. A Namibian politician says Germany perpetrated the genocide and can therefore not purport to make a just and neutral decision on reparations.
Germany has been dictating. And for me, it was like a case of you have a murderer or a rapist, and this person is the one to decide whether I have raped or not, and should I find myself guilty, what could be the best punishment or verdict that I can give myself? So that is how the whole process was not acceptable to us.
Now, for an incisive analysis of this subject, we contacted Dr. Muginde Kajiua, Secretary General of the Oba Herero Traditional Authority. Thanks a lot for joining us today, Doctor. Now, can you first briefly elaborate to us on how the Nama and the Herero genocide took place in present-day Namibia during the German colonial rule?
The Nama and the Oba Herero genocide is a genocide. The German government issued two extermination orders, written, translated in local languages, distributed, and then they implemented their intention as planned or as intended and carried out to the letter. Rounded Hereros and Namas refugees or prisoners of war, put them into concentration camp, ensure that they are put to heavy labor and also hanged, make sure that the population is reduced. In fact, at the end of the genocide, General Lothar von Trotta stated that the Herero Nation would never continue to exist as it was. He has completed his role, his job successfully.
Thank you for that, and we'll be back with more.
Germany agreed to pay Namibia 1.1 billion euros as it officially recognized the Herero-Nama genocide. Angela Merkel's government claims the payment amounts to a gesture of reconciliation, but not legally binding reparations. Herrero and NAMA leaders dismissed the deal as a public relations coup because it did not include funds deemed reparations. It has also been hugely disappointing to the Herrero and NAMA that the funds will be distributed over a period covering 3 decades.
The Herrero chief, Bekui Rukoro, who died recently of COVID-19, was leading fierce opposition to the offer by Germany. He accused Germany of pursuing a racist policy by refusing to negotiate directly with those affected by the genocide.
And the only difference, Germany is continuing to refuse to sit down with us as victims of their genocide and extermination campaign, is because we are black Africans. So it's a racist policy.
Now, Germany has offered a 1.1 billion euro settlement, which has been rejected by the Herrero and NAMA leaders. Why have they rejected this deal?
We cannot agree to a product within which we are excluded. And in any case, the amount of money that they have agreed to is a slap in the face, is an embarrassment for the Namibian state. It's not even the value of land, over 50 million hectares of land confiscated in Namibia equates that much. The land alone that is taken by the colonizers, it's about 70, 75 billion euros. Not alone the 100,000 lives that are lost, the displacement of people in the neighboring countries.
Descendants of the affected communities rejected the text of a joint declaration between the Namibian government and Germany, which omitted the word reparation. They also called for the renegotiation of the agreement with a focus on increasing the financial amount offered by Germany.
Now, what do you think should be done for justice to be served to the Herrero and NAMA people?
We have been consistent that we must revert back to the National Assembly resolution, which was unanimously adopted by the Namibian Parliament, which says the victim communities, the two governments, must sit around the table, and the victim communities must be represented by their chosen leaders as victims of genocide, and they must propose to negotiate a package that addresses the needs of the victims wherever they are. So the negotiations must start afresh. We will not accept what is on the table.
Now, as you continue the struggle for the rights of the Herrero and NAMA communities, what's your message to the international community?
We're calling upon the international communities, peace-loving people, people that are fighting for justice, restorative justice. We're calling on that community to support us in our struggle for restorative justice. We hope the national governments will put more pressure on Germany to recognize the genocide and pay reparations. We will continue this fight. We will bring it to the United Nations, to the governments of the world, to ensure that Germany is pressurized through political pressure and negotiations that recognizes genocide and pays reparation that is due to the victims of genocide in Namibia.
Well, thank you very much. The Secretary General of the Herrero Traditional Authority in Namibia. Now, here at Press TV, we shall continue updating you on the continued struggle for reparations by the oppressed Herrero and NAMA communities in Namibia. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. And please, do send us your comments through our social media handle. Thanks a lot, and goodbye for now.
the limelight.
One local risk assessment specialist said the building's collapse could be a canary in the coal mine type event as sea levels rise, says Brett Wilkins Ryder in an article published under the heading, Experts Warn, Florida Tower Disaster is Climate Emergency Wake-Up Call. Stay tuned for more. In the search for answers following recently disintegration of a high-rise condominium tower near Miami, some experts are cautiously pointing to the climate emergency as a possible culprit, or, at the very least, a risk multiplier in the disaster, underscoring the need for urgent climate and infrastructure action. With 11 confirmed deaths and 150 people still missing following the partial collapse of Champlain Tower South in Surfside on June 24th, rescuing survivors and retrieving victims' bodies remain authorities' top priority. However, officials and experts have also begun the long and daunting task of determining what caused the building to fail. A 2018 engineering report on the 12-story tower noted design flaws and major structural damage, including a deteriorating roof, defective waterproofing and crumbling concrete columns and rusting rebar in the building's underground garage. The report warned that some of these problems could cause exponential damage in the future. With so much well-documented existing damage and with repairs to the building underway at the time it disintegrated, experts have been reluctant to attribute the collapse to any single cause. However, numerous scientists and other experts say that rising sea levels and more intense tidal flooding related to the climate emergency could have played a significant role in the disaster. There is little doubt among experts that a warming planet due to human activity is causing sea levels rise, and it is certain that rising waters can infiltrate the porous limestone upon the southeastern Florida building's stand, potentially degrading their foundations over time. As a 5.9-inch rise in local sea levels and 320% surge in nuisance flooding in the area since mid-1990s attests, Metro Miami is particularly susceptible to the consequences of the climate emergency. Last year, a report from Resources for the Future, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank, stated that Miami is one of the most at-risk cities in the world from the damages caused by coastal flooding and storms. Atorod Azizinami, who directs the Moss School of Construction, Infrastructure, and Sustainability at Florida International University, FIU, told the Palm Beach Post that climate change can play a role in disasters like the Champlain Tower South collapse. It can cause settlement of the ground with sea level rise and corrosion. Zhang Renpeng, director of the International Center for Adaptation Planning and Design at the University of Florida, told the Palm Beach Post that sea level rise does cause potential corrosion, and if that was happening, it's possible it could not handle the weight of the building. I think this could be a wake-up call for coastal developments, warned Peng. Albert Slapp, chief executive of the Boca Raton, Florida-based construction risk assessment company, Risk Footprint, explained to the Washington Post that groundwater enters the pores of the concrete and ultimately weakens it and erodes it. So the foundations are subject to a lot of geological forces that could compact the soil underneath. It could cause voids. We just don't know. Slab said the Chamblain Tower South disaster could be a canary in the coal mine type event. It's not just one building, he added. This could be something that could affect other buildings. Climate scientists predict an acceleration in sea level rise in southeastern Florida with a projected increase of 10 to 17 inches by 2040, 21 to 54 inches by 2070, and 40 to 136 inches by 2120. Land subsidence, the sudden sinking or gradual settling of the ground surface, is also linked to the climate emergency. Shimon Wedowinski, a professor at Florida International University's Institute of Environment, said an analysis of a space-based radar data revealed signs of such subsidence. At the site of the tower disaster in 1990s, we reported about 2 millimeters per year over a period of 6 years, so that comes to about 12 millimeters, about half an inch, or about the width of your finger, Wedowinski told the Weather Channel, adding, so small things and slow processes can accumulate if you give them enough time. Separately, Wedowinski said that when we measure subsidence or when we see movement of the buildings, it's worth checking why it happens. We cannot say that what is the reason for that from the satellite images, but we can say there was movement here, he added. Like many cities around the world, Miami is taking steps in an effort to mitigate the effects of rising sea levels and sinking land. According to Miami's stormwater master plan, installing a system of pumps, drainage, and sea walls would cost approximately $4 billion and still leave some areas without adequate protection. However, experts warn that only urgent transformational action can avert worst-case climate scenarios, and that attempting to merely treat the symptoms of the climate emergency with measures like sea walls will ultimately fail. In a 2019 Popular article, essayist Sarah Miller wrote that since Miami is built on limestone, which soaks up water like a sponge, walls are not very useful. In Miami, seawater will just go under a wall like a salty ghost. It will come up through the pipes and seep up around the manholes. It will soak into the sand and find its way into caves and get under the water table and push the groundwater up. So while walls might keep the clogs of Holland dry, they cannot offer similar protection to the stilettos of Miami Beach, she said. Harold Wanless, a geologist and sea level rise expert at the University of Miami, told The Guardian that every sandy barrier island, every low-lying coast from Miami to Mumbai will become inundated and it will be difficult to maintain functional infrastructure. Vanless said you can't put valves in sewers and put it sea levels, but the problem is the water will keep coming up through the limestone. You're not going to stop this. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, giving in the way of Allah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. In Islam, giving a percentage of your annual profitable disposable income or savings is an obligation upon every qualifying Muslim. Not only does this go a long way towards promoting an equal and balanced society, but sharing our God-given wealth amongst others is a way of ridding ourselves of any greed and materialism and purifying our souls in the process. So giving in the way of Allah, fulfilling our religious responsibility of paying Islamic taxes, is actually a blessing for us to be able to purify our souls. Not only is giving to and helping others a core principle that is highly encouraged in Islam, but it is also an act which greatly pleases Allah and is generously rewarded in return. Allah promises to reward us in multiple ways, both in this world and in our hereafter, for sharing our wealth with those less fortunate than ourselves. Brothers and sisters, this world is a place of test and trial. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has sent us here so He can test us, so He can give us a choice and then let us take care of our own destiny through the decisions we make. So if we are seeing that there are needy people around us, there are people who are trying, they're struggling, but they're not able to meet their both ends and their families are distressed, it is a responsibility for a true believer to step forward and help those people, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala expects you to do that. Thank you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are talking about giving in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We said not only does helping others open up our eyes to the ongoing issues of the world, but it also instills compassion and empathy for others within us and pulls us away from potentially selfless acts as a result. The notion of giving to others also acts as a great reminder that nothing that we own in this world actually belongs to us to begin with. In fact, it is all given to us by Allah and can just as easily be taken away from us in the same way it was given. It is our duty as fellow human beings to ensure we combine our efforts to eradicate poverty and hunger from this world. We may not be able to do that to its entirety, but that's okay. You're only going to be questioned for what you could have done. See, sometimes we become too result-oriented and pragmatic. We say that, oh, it's not like if I feed, let's say, 50 or 100 people or take care of their house rents or, you know, provide them with a shelter, it's not like, you know, the poverty is going to just vanish and be eradicated. Hence, I decide, Brother Shaitan makes me decide that I don't carry out that good act. Well, two things real quick over there. One is, you are only responsible for what Allah has given you the abilities and capabilities of doing. Number two, when you say that it's not like poverty can be eradicated through this action of yours, well, maybe it can. Just imagine there are other people who are thinking the same. You stepping forward and doing the right thing for the sake of Allah is going to be a source of encouragement for others to step forward and do that right thing too. And that can ultimately, inshallah, if it builds up, result in the eradication of poverty from this earth. Think about it. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Nearly 500 people may have been killed by record-breaking temperatures in Canada's westernmost province, as officials warned a grim death toll from the heat dome could rise again as more deaths are reported. On Friday, 2nd of July, British Columbia's chief coroner said that 719 sudden and unexpected deaths had been reported over the past week, triple the number during a similar period in a typical year. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Leighton Secco. The piece is titled "Record Heat Wave May Have Killed 500 People in Western Canada." Nearly 500 people may have been killed by record-breaking temperatures in Canada's westernmost province of British Columbia, as officials warned a grim death toll from the heat dome could rise again, as more deaths are reported. On Friday, 2nd of July, British Columbia's chief coroner said that 719 sudden and unexpected deaths had been reported over the past week, triple the number during a similar period in a typical year. We are releasing this information as it is believed likely the extreme weather British Columbia has experienced in the past week is a significant contributing factor to the increased number of deaths, the chief coroner, Lisa Lapointe, said in a statement. The coroner's office said it would typically expect close to 230 deaths in a similar period. The overall total will probably rise after more communities provide data, but the chief coroner, Lisa Lapointe, said the province has been a promising downward trend in recent days as the heat ebbs and shifts eastward. Officials have cautioned it will probably take months to determine the exact cause of death for hundreds of residents, but they say heat played a significant role in the surge in fatalities, especially among seniors in the province. Many of the deaths experienced over the past week were among older individuals living alone in private residences with minimal ventilation, Lisa Lapointe said in her statement. In a region of the country accustomed to mild summer temperatures, communities were forced to scramble to find ways to help vulnerable residents stay safe amid blistering temperatures. But regional officials are facing growing questions over the response to the heatwave crisis. On Thursday, 1st of July, the head of the province's emergency health service apologized after residents were made to wait hours for ambulances during the worst of the heatwave. Global News reported that British Columbia's Emergency Services Center, which allows paramedics to be redeployed to high-need areas, wasn't activated until after the worst of the heat wave had passed. The weather system that enveloped large swathes of the Pacific Northwest broke 103 heat records across British Columbia, Alberta, Yukon, and Northwestern Territories earlier this week, according to Environment Canada. The heat has done little to help a province already vulnerable to the devastating effects of wildfires. At least two people are believed to have died in a wildfire that destroyed the village of Lytton on Wednesday, 30th of June. Police attempted to search for missing residents, but dangerous conditions have prevented them from entering the community. Late on Friday, 2nd of July, 136 active wildfires were reported in British Columbia, including nine which were of concern, according to officials. The dry, hot weather is expected to continue for the next week, hampering efforts to gain control over the wildfires. With an unprecedented heat wave that has left hundreds of people dead in British Columbia, Canada's westernmost province is now battling a fresh threat. More than 130 wildfires are burning across the province. As of late on Thursday, 1st of July, 86 of which started in the past 2 days. Evacuation orders and alerts have already gone out in a dozen communities. The province's premier, John Horgan, suggested that the crisis could become dire enough to see the Canadian military being deployed. There was a similar picture in western United States. Hundreds of firefighters battled the high heat against several wildfires in the forests of Northern California, where the flames have already forced many communities to evacuate. Mount Shasta, the volcano that towers over the region, was shrouded on Thursday, 1st of July, in a haze of smoke plumes so huge they could easily be seen in images from weather satellites in space. In British Columbia, Western Canada, it was supposed to be a week of tentative celebration. Thursday was the day that the province's COVID-19 state of emergency was lifted. But now the province is likely to be facing a new state of emergency over the wildfires. Absolutely, we may well depending on how the wildfire season starts to unfold, require a provincial state of emergency, such as we have seen in our past five seasons in this province, the province's public safety minister, Mike Farnworth, said. In the village of Lytton, where a wildfire struck with such fury that residents had mere minutes to evacuate the village, an unknown number of residents were still unaccounted for on Friday, 2nd of July. Community Facebook groups were brimming with posts by residents desperate to track down their missing loved ones. Meanwhile, the Vancouver Sun has reported at least two people died attempting to shelter in a hole in the ground as the wildfire raged on.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Televised speech on the eve of the 13th presidential election, June 16th, 2021. People's duty with regard to the elections, participation in the elections, and what kind of participation. In the Islamic Republic, Republic is one part and Islamic is another. If Republic is not a part of it, then the Islamic Republic will not be realized. On the other hand, there are many political aspects, and the political effects are productive and full of blessings, some of which I will mention later on. This is exactly why all the satanic centers of power in the world, those who oppose and bear animosity towards the Islamic Republic, are particularly against and opposed to the elections. In all our elections over these decades, the media has always been used as a political means to destroy people's mindset toward the elections and to interfere in some way in the elections in order to prevent the splendor and glory of the Iranian elections from being shown. Over these many years, all the elections have been held on time, even if they cannot see this. They haven't been cancelled or postponed even one day. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu Akbar. People have come to the ballot boxes and cast their votes. Of course, there has been hostile propaganda. This propaganda has always existed before and after the elections. Perhaps there is no other country in the world that can be found whose elections have been attacked by the enemies this much. For this election, which will take place on Friday, the day after tomorrow, the US media, the UK media, and their mercenaries who are working for these media have been working for several months now. They are working very hard in an attempt to try to throw doubt on the elections, downplay people's participation, and make allegations against the elections of the Islamic Republic in some way. They say all different kinds of things in this respect. Well, their goal is for the elections to not to be held as desired by the Islamic Republic. What does this mean? It means that they want the people to distance themselves from the system, because a lack of participation in the elections naturally means people distancing themselves from the Islamic Republic. This is the goal they pursue.
Around the world with reporters.
Yemen's Ministry of Electricity held a sit-in protest in front of the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a to call on the international community to step in and pressure Saudi Arabia to stop detaining Yemeni oil vessels. The ministry said it is unable to generate power anymore due to the lack of fuel.
Electricity is an essential service and has nothing to do with any political conflicts. The power sector in Yemen has been heavily affected since the first moment of the war. The Saudi-led coalition has directly targeted all electric power plants, and this is a great tragedy for us. The UN has not done anything to end the suffering of Yemenis. We demand the lifting of the siege and releasing the oil ships so we can generate electricity again.
At the same place, Yemeni children organized a gallery for the drawings. The gallery was named The U.S. Kills Our Childhood and exhibited children's drawings that show the suffering of Yemeni children due to the ongoing conflict.
We participated in this protest to tell the United Nations, which classified Ansarullah in its blacklist of groups violating children's rights. We Yemenis demand our rights like any other people, on top of which is the lifting of the siege imposed on us by Saudi Arabia.
How many fathers and mothers have lost their children? This is a massive crime. This is tyranny. We are little children. We have no fault.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a devastating war on the impoverished country in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children, and imposing an all-out blockade. Yemenis have held hundreds of protests here in front of the United Nations office, but the international body has not yet taken any strict measures to end the suffering of the millions of Yemenis. That is why the UN describes the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. عبد اللطيف الوشلي صنعاء.
The leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, is standing trial for allegations of culpable homicide, unlawful assembly, disruption of public peace, among other charges which the Islamic cleric has denied. Rounding up his address to the court, the leader of the defense team explained that the prosecution has not established any case against Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki. He said none of the people accused of the crimes attributed it to his client, and the court has released many of them.
If we feel that no prima facie case has been established against your client, you make a no-case submission, and that is what has happened in this case. So we are waiting for the ruling of the court.
The prosecution has presented a total of 15 witnesses, including Nigerian military officers. But Zazaki's defense team said all the witnesses that were brought before the court confirmed that they did not see Sheikh Zazaki during the attack by the army.
The prosecution called 15 witnesses. We felt that no case has been made to warrant our clients being asked to give evidence. In other words, we address the court to defend that there is nothing to defend on the part of our client.
The trial judge adjourned the case to July 28, when he is expected to deliver his ruling on the no-case submission by Zazaki's defense team. Sheikh Zazaki has been in detention since December 2015 after soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked his home and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters. Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria have continued with their protests, demanding the release of Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat. They have always insisted that the Islamic cleric is an innocent man who has suffered persecution by the Nigerian government. Lanjum Abdullahi, Kaduna.
Bashir Ahmed Baba is a free man now. 12 years back, he was detained at the Gujarat state of India for a crime he was unaware of.
I used to work for a German-based NGO. I and my colleague, who was non-Kashmiri, had gone to attend a training workshop on children with disabilities. It was a two-week-long program, but I was detained on the sixth day while my colleague was set free.
Baba was detained under a controversial Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, or UAPA, and was accused of making bombs in soft drink cans.
I was unaware of what I was being questioned about. I even couldn't read the charge sheet because it was in the local language. But one thing I was sure about is that one day I would walk free because I knew I was innocent. But I never knew it would take 12 years to prove it.
Unlawful activity is defined vaguely in the law as any action, whether by an individual or an association, which disclaims, questions, disrupts, or is intended to disrupt the sovereignty and territorial integrity of India, or causes or is intended to cause disaffection against India. According to the National Crime Records Bureau data, there's a rising graph of UAPA cases in Jammu and Kashmir. The UAPA law has come under stern criticism after several activists and journalists in India were booked under it by the Hindu nationalist Narendra Modi-led Bharatiya Janata Party. Scores of Kashmiris are languishing in the jails across India. Providing legal aid and frequent meeting with the prisoners has become a challenge for their families.
In these 12 years, I have seen him once, that only after I sold my gold earring. We were drained financially after his father died of cancer, so going to him was out of our bounds.
Analysts say unlawful detention is a violation of human rights, and the covenants of civil and political rights say such people need to be compensated for unlawful detention, and for those who have falsely implicated them also need to be tried in the name of malicious prosecution.
In India, in case of Muslims in general and Kashmiris in particular, the law enforcing authorities have been given a license to harass, implicate and detain without any cause. That is why we find Muslim population in India is just 15%, whereas 35% prisoners of India are Muslims, and most of them are falsely implicated.
Sheikh added, Kashmir is an exceptional case where New Delhi has placed laws that allow authorities to detain people without any reason. Baba is happy to be back and is rejoicing the reunion with his family members. however, is in a constant dilemma where and how to start fresh. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
For the first time in decades, Canada Day celebrations have been mostly muted as the country sees old wounds reopened. Various cities scrapped the celebrations following a series of horrific discoveries of unmarked graves around former Catholic schools for Indigenous children. Calls to scale back or cancel celebrations snowballed in May and June when almost 1,000 unmarked graves were found. Another discovery this week, comprising 182 graves of children aged 7 to 15, made matters even worse. The new findings have fueled outrage in the country over a lack of information and accountability regarding violations of Indigenous peoples' rights. The graves remind people of the horrors experienced by thousands of kids that were supposed to be assimilated into the white society in church-run boarding schools. Rallies have been held to honor over 4,000 victims of Canada's infamous residential schools, while Indigenous leaders have been calling for a thorough investigation. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has described the discoveries as a shameful reminder of systemic racism and urged the Catholic Church to take responsibility. The Roman Catholic Church is yet to issue a formal apology. Activists, however, believe the government is trying to put the onus on the Catholic Church and downplay its central role.
The Canadian government currently is trying to kind of put the onus more on the Catholic Church, on the churches, but obviously the Canadian government is central to this whole horrific history and ongoing colonization.
Indigenous children are not the only victims of racism in Canada. Reports say thousands of Indigenous women and girls have been murdered or gone missing in the country over the past 30 years. The National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls says a genocide is being perpetrated. But that's not all. A deadly attack on a Muslim family last month in Ontario and attacks on women wearing hijab in Alberta testify to the fact that racism has deep roots in the Canadian society. A new opinion poll shows some 36% of the Indigenous people and 42% of minorities believe Canada is a racist country. Canada, a country with a dark colonial history, has for decades depicted itself as an outspoken critic of racism and a leading advocate of human rights. But the latest discoveries of Indigenous graves and attacks against Muslims show Canada is yet to take meaningful measures to root out racism in its own society.
Every year in late June and early July, Iranians flock to the graveyard in southern Tehran and sprinkle rose petals on tombs. Buried here are the victims of a terrorist attack in 1981 that bombed the central office of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, killing 73 key officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, who was viewed as the second man of the nascent Islamic Republic after its founder, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini.
I lost my father in the 1981 bombing of the Islamic Republic Party's headquarters. I was 9 back then. I still miss him so much, and I come here every year to commemorate him.
The killing of the Iranian politicians back then was a terrorist act that was supported by the U.S. The terrorists are now residing in France, so we ask the French government to hand them over to face justice.
The formidable Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization took responsibility for the 1981 bombing. Known as the MKO, the terror group has a history of assassinations against Iranian statesmen and civilians, killing at least 12,000 Iranians.
Ask any Iranian about the MKO, and they will call them munafiqin, the Persian word for hypocrites. This is because they call themselves the crusaders of people's cause, but in fact, they killed people to climb to power. What's even more ironic is the fact that the U.S. and some other Western countries nourish the MKO terrorists.
This man is believed to be the spearhead of the 1981 terror attack. After the incident, Mohammad Reza Kolahi